And we have a winner. What changes for Texas in a Biden-Harris administration and how quickly? Calibrating expectations and much more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. With the presidential contest now called, attention turns to fixing what's broken and moving forward. Some projections from a veteran politics watcher and professor. The state's top law enforcement official facing a mushrooming scandal and new questions about how much longer he can hang on as AG. Also, digging a little deeper into the Latina turnout in so-called battleground states. And not your parents' biodiesel. As oil prices fall, attention turns to renewable diesels. All those stories and more when the Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this ninth day of November. I'm David Brown. The Republican Party's only living former president made a call from his Texas home over the weekend, a traditional gesture, to the winner of the presidential contest in an era that seems long past. It was an expected grace note in American politics. The New York Times reports that after George W. Bush spoke on Sunday with Joe Biden, Bush released a statement. Though we have political differences, I know Joe Biden to be a good man who has won his opportunity to lead and unify our country. Close quote. But what's notable on this Monday is the reaction from others in Bush's party, or lack thereof when it comes to reactions. Yesterday, Texas Senator Ted Cruz insisted the race isn't over, appearing to back President Trump's push to challenge the outcome in the courts. While Senator John Cornyn appears to have taken the path preferred by many Republican politicians at the moment, silence on the question of the outcome of the race. Now, we've said since before Election Day we'd be following the Associated Press's call, and while that has no legal bearing per se, we and other news organizations around the world are moving forward with the presumption that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will be taking the oaths of office on the west front steps of the U.S. Capitol on January 20th, 2021. On that day and thereafter, what changes for Texas, and how careful should Texans be in calibrating their expectations? Carlos Huerta is a political science professor at Texas A&M University in Corpus Christi. Professor, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Oh, thank you. Looking forward to our conversation.
On President-elect Joe Biden's transition website, buildbackbetter.com, his team has highlighted four main priorities for his administration to tackle on day one. That's COVID-19, economic recovery, racial equity, and climate change. That's a lot to tackle on day one of anyone's presidency, but let's begin with COVID-19. Under a Biden administration, what do you see changing when it comes to the federal response to COVID-19?
Well, one thing I think is going to be changing with the federal response is we're going to see a renewed emphasis on the medical experts, and I would think that we're going to see the Center for Disease Control get a more high-profile role and perhaps less of the political pressure to say things. And so I think we're going to get a clear response from the federal government and a clear direction on how to proceed, perhaps more resources provided for states in a more coordinated manner.
And so would that change in terms of how we deal with the issue here in Texas, perhaps more guidance at the federal level or from the CDC?
Yeah, that would be my expectation. It's my understanding in these policy issues with public health, it's not as if the federal government will come in and, you know, dictate to states how to do things. We would hear comments that there were disputes in the CDC and other federal agencies about how to give guidance and what to say. And that's one thing I think will be clearer. You know, states will still have, you know, a great deal of autonomy, but very clear guidance from the federal government and how to respond.
Let's move on to economic recovery. It's looking more likely Congress won't be passing another stimulus bill in the foreseeable future, perhaps not until Inauguration Day. And at that point, we don't know yet, but the Senate might still be Republican. How do you see that playing out?
One thing I might point out is, you know, Congress did pass a bipartisan bill for COVID relief or an economic bill back in the spring. So, you know, we do see evidence in the past that Congress can work in a bipartisan way with the president. And so we're going to see an effort, I would expect, from the Biden administration to pass something. If we don't see any kind of legislative action taken, I would expect to see a Biden administration use executive action as in as many places as they can to provide relief.
We're having to click through these rather quickly, but they're all on the agenda. Racial equity, of course, after this past summer of unrest and protest in cities like Austin over police funding. Do you see a change in the federal approach from a Biden administration when it comes to police funding and diverting funds to social services?
Well, I'm not so sure about the funding part. You know, a lot of it's local. There are grants from the federal government that can help with things like the social services you've talked about. My suspicion is the biggest difference is going to be the Department of Justice's approach to this. The Obama administration had used consent decrees with police departments that have a history of violating rights, such as Ferguson, Missouri, and those ended in the Trump administration. I would expect to see the Justice Department reinstate those and pursue a more aggressive strategy on policing.
Immigration has been obviously a priority for the Trump administration. How does that change in a Biden administration?
Well, one thing I think we're going to see change is when it comes to Dreamers. Much of the action that the Trump administration has gone through executive orders. So I would expect that we're not going to see that same kind of action with executive orders. Sometimes border wall funding is tied into immigration. Once again, I think, you know, that's the place we're going to see executive orders change. There really wasn't legislative built border walls. It was executive orders. So those are some areas. And we'll see many members of Congress, Republican and Democrat, have all talked about trying to pass a bipartisan immigration bill. Well, here's an opportunity. So I expect we'll see efforts in Congress to try to pass some kind of immigration reform bills.
And climate change, what can Texans expect there? Big oil state, of course.
Well, I think it's interesting. People, you know, when they think about climate change, think about big oil in Texas. Texas is also a state of clean energy. Where I am in Corpus Christi, wind farms are real big. And so, we're going to have traditional energy. But I think, you know, any kind of push to renewable energies, you know, solar, wind, hey, we've got a lot of both. So I think there's opportunities for Texas.
Carlos Huerta is political science professor at Texas A&M Corpus Christi. Professor, thanks again.
Oh, you're welcome.
Texas's top lawman is no stranger to legal troubles of his own. State Attorney General Ken Paxton was indicted on securities fraud charges just months after taking office back in 2015. But fallout from a new scandal involving allegations of doing favors for a political donor, whistleblower retaliation, and now an alleged affair have more people asking if Paxton can continue to perform his job. Lauren McGaughey is an investigative government reporter for the Dallas Morning News and one of the state's top experts on everything Ken Paxton. Lauren, thanks for joining us again on The Standard.
Thanks for having me, David.
So let's set the scene here. This story begins in earnest last month when seven top aides to the AG accused him of participating in bribery, improper use of his office, and more. No specifics mentioned in this whistleblower letter, but it turns out these allegations were related to a donor.
That's right, David. They said that these allegations related to a man named Nate Paul. He's an Austin-based real estate developer. He has properties all over Texas, including Austin, Dallas, and Houston, as well as out of state. And these seven employees said that Paxton was using the power of his office to help Nate Paul, and they had some very serious concerns about it. And they were so concerned that they told law enforcement.
But so far, no charges have been brought against the AG in connection with these allegations?
That's right. No charges. We can't even firm up with the FBI whether they are actually looking into this because they don't confirm or deny the existence of investigations. But those allegations have been forwarded to federal officials.
We should also talk about the fate of those aides who put their names on the whistleblower letter that prompted all this, right?
That's right. All of the aides except for one, as far as we know, are now no longer at the agency. Three of them were fired, three resigned, and one is on investigative leave related to this whole issue that he raised. And apparently, the attorney general is firing back, saying these former aides are the ones at fault, not him.
So now this new wrinkle, some news that you broke, another connection between the attorney general and his donor revealed in a deposition. What can you tell us about this?
We received a deposition last week related to a civil case that this donor, Nate Paul, and a Austin-based charity are waging between them. And in the case, the developer, Nate Paul, confirmed that he had hired someone he believed on Paxson's recommendation to be a project manager for his real estate companies. And that woman, we have learned from sources, had allegedly had an affair with the attorney general.
What does Ken Paxton have to say in response to all this reporting?
Well, we have not received a response directly from Mr. Paxton. We have reached out. We've asked him to sit down with us about the complaints from the officials. We've asked him about the affair. And so far, we're getting radio silence. We did get a response from Nate Paul, the donor's attorney, saying, you know, they have a lot of employees and this woman was just one of them and they don't delve into their employees' personal lives. But so far, the attorney general hasn't, as far as I know, given any formal interviews to any of the large newspapers or media outlets in the state.
Well, so far, Paxton's trial on the securities charges has been delayed for 5 years over side issues. Is there any reason to believe this new scandal will affect Paxton's ability to keep his job? What's next?
That we don't know. We reached out to the top Republican officials in the state at the end of last week to ask them about these new allegations about the affair and the alleged affair's ties to this donor. They have not responded, but previously the governor and lieutenant governor have called the new allegations against Paxton concerning, which is something they didn't do back 5 years ago when he was first charged with securities fraud. So as far as we know, the two sets of allegations are not tied to each other, but we'll really have to wait and see what the top elected Republicans in the state have to say in the weeks ahead.
Lauren McGaughy is an investigative reporter based in Austin for the Dallas Morning News. We'll link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Lauren, thanks again.
Thanks, David.
Wells Dunbar is our social media editor. Hello, Wells.
Hi, David. Echoing what we heard at the top of the show, we're hearing from our friends and listeners out there about what they'd like to see from a Joe Biden administration. Tim Figler says he'd like to see an initiative to retrain all the roughnecks that have been put out of work by the most recent oil crash to build and install wind and solar farms. Let's start building a better future, he says. Randy Smith similarly says he'd like to see infrastructure spending, job training programs, fixed to the tax code and national health insurance. And Bala Krishnan says electoral reform, immigration reform, action on COVID and more, no Twitter. And speaking of Twitter, we heard via Twitter from plenty of folks this weekend about where they were, what their thoughts were the moment the election was called for Joe Biden. I'll be back with plenty of those reactions later in the show.
If we haven't heard from you, you know what to do. Look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar's looking for you. He's going to be joining us again in about 35 minutes or so with much more of the Talk of Texas on this Monday.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where faculty do research for the greater good. Like biology professor Dean Williams, who uses genetic mapping to help save horned lizards from extinction. More at tcu.edu/conservation. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. With the pandemic, remote and online-based doctor's visits have gone mainstream in Texas. Despite longtime resistance from some quarters prior to COVID-19, telehealth has become a go-to for lots of folks. But for some patients who've long had difficulty finding providers in Texas, this shift is transformational. Houston Public Media's Sarah Willa Ernst reports on how telemedicine has started to improve access to transgender health care.
It's about lunchtime, and Naomi West goes over to a navy blue briefcase in her room. That's where she says she keeps the most important items in her life, including her medication, which she takes daily for gender-affirming hormone therapy.
Spironolactone, I have escitalopram for anxiety, I have estradiol.
West started hormone therapy just over a year ago at the Planned Parenthood Clinic in Houston. This therapy can give patients more traditionally masculine or feminine features. This briefcase, Wes says, is also where she typically keeps her research notes. But funding for her PhD at Rice University has dried up due to the pandemic. So to save money, she moved in with her sister who lives in Austin. And luckily, that was right when office visits at her clinic went virtual.
So this was really a new endeavor for us where we were offering telehealth to folks in their homes. And it was a very quick transition.
That's Dr. Bhavik Kumar, the medical director of primary and trans care at Planned Parenthood Gulf Coast, where telehealth this year has taken off, replacing almost a third of all office appointments. In Austin, patient Naomi West, in theory, could have found a new doctor, but that would have meant an interruption in her care. Dr. Kumar says that can be really tough for patients.
When you've already made that connection and you like and trust your provider, being able to hold on to that can be so meaningful for folks, especially folks that are already marginalized within healthcare.
For checkups, patients can connect with their providers through video chat, and in-person care like blood work can be done at a local lab much closer to where the patient lives. Dr. Kumar says most notably, the clinics have started seeing patients from hundreds of miles away.
We are definitely seeing folks from different parts of the state and further away than we did before.
Rural areas in Texas like Lufkin and Iola, even out-of-state patients in Alabama and Mississippi too. And that's because hormone therapy is hard to find in most Texas towns, let alone providers trained in transgender competency.
As a transgender person, you have so many questions and uncertainties for your safety, right?
That's Evan Mahoney. They're a patient advocate at the Kind Clinic, an LGBTQ-focused healthcare provider in San Antonio and Austin.
Are there going to be gender-neutral restrooms? Maybe the provider is trans-affirming, but what if the front desk is rude? Or what if I feel afraid that somebody is going to, you know, confront me in the parking lot?
According to a 2017 poll by NPR, Harvard, and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, 20% of transgender people surveyed said they've avoided seeking medical care for fear that they'd be discriminated against. And that makes telehealth a lot less risky for trans folks, says Mahoney.
All I have to do is hang up, and I'm not going to be trying to strategize of how am I going to leave this place that makes me feel physically unsafe.
Although the pandemic has improved access through telehealth, COVID-19 has also created major barriers. In the spring, like many procedures deemed non-essential, gender-affirming surgeries were postponed.
I know a lot of people in the community who had to cancel the surgery because they had lost income.
Trans folks, many of whom work in the service industry, have lost their jobs, making it harder to afford care that is expensive and not always covered by insurance. For Naomi West, even though Austin has many healthcare resources, she still travels 3 hours to Houston to get blood work done at Planned Parenthood. But she has no doubt that the drive is worth it. It has helped her overcome so many feelings of gender dysphoria.
I would say, you know, what hasn't the medication done for me? I feel like a completely different person.
I'm Sarah Will Ernst in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider. Proud to be on the job with Texans who are working safe and keeping communities strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Last week, Royal Dutch Shell announced it would be shutting down its Convent refinery on Louisiana's Gulf Coast, leaving some 700 Shell employees plus another 400 contractors looking for jobs. It's just the latest example of how the pandemic has fundamentally reshaped the energy industry. The ongoing economic slowdown has seen some oil majors shift their operations, placing a stronger emphasis on renewables and other more environmentally friendly technology. With a wave of refinery closures happening, however, what does the future of a changing industry look like? Joining us now is Matt Smith. He's been thinking about this question as Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data. Matt, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you, David.
So we've seen those refinery plans setting to shut down in recent weeks. Shell, like I mentioned, also a PBF energy refinery in New Jersey. How much of this is COVID, and how much of this is part of a bigger sea change in your reckoning?
It's a bit of both, David. So as you mentioned there, there's been a lot of refineries, nearly 10 in North America, that have been targeted for a shutdown or to be idled since the start of the pandemic. So the situation is being exacerbated by the coronavirus. There's no doubt about that. You have refinery margins, which essentially measure the profitability of refining a barrel of oil into gasoline or diesel. They've been considerably lower this year simply because demand has been crushed. But the drumbeat is building for peak gasoline demand. So whether that's due to the behavioral changes we've seen this year in terms of working from home, or if it's technological advances due to greater fuel efficiency, or if it's simply just that move towards more electric vehicles, there is that sea change underway there, it seems.
Seems like this is, you know, whenever you have one door sort of close, another door opens, the saying goes. And it's mm-hmm. it strikes me that a lot of companies are now seeing this as a potential window of opportunity to think about alternatives.
Yeah, for sure. So some of these refineries are being reconfigured. So there's one in San Francisco, Phillips 66 refinery. They're not closed it yet, but they're looking to close it in 2023. And they will look to reopen it to produce renewable fuels. And so they're projected to be the world's largest renewable fuels plant. The same is being done as well. There's a Holly Frontier refinery in Shane, Wyoming. And that's being retrofitted at the moment to pivot. So there is definitely some momentum being built here for renewables.
When you say renewables, you're talking about like renewable diesel?
Yeah. So specifically with that Holly Frontier one, it is renewable diesel. And what that is essentially is it's not a fossil fuel. It's made up of renewable resources such as natural fats or vegetable oils or greases. But it's the production of it that is making it renewable diesel, because you have these sophisticated refiners that are be able to refine it just as they would any other petroleum product, and so that's what they're looking to do there.
And I gather that's the main distinction from biodiesel, right? It's how it's processed, because renewable diesel apparently is highly processed, and so it doesn't you don't face the same challenges of freezing temperature and storage and all that sort of thing that you do with sort of more DIY solutions in biodiesel.
Yeah, exactly. And you do have a focus with renewable diesel as well. So from a global basis, a half of all global imports of renewable diesel go into the U.S. West Coast, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, I think it's something like 15,000 barrels per day, something like that. It's not a small amount. And the reason that it's going in there is because of the economic benefits, because of California's low carbon fuel standard. And so there are already certain regions, those more kind of more environmentally friendly focused ones, that are already putting this renewable diesel to work, essentially.
Watch this space. Matt Smith does. He's director of commodity research for Clipper Data. Matt, thanks again.
Thank you, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town while keeping safety in mind. Shopping, Gulf seafood, and family attractions like Moody Gardens and more. Details at galveston.com.
Live from the Texas Newsroom, I'm Rachel Osier-Lindley. While some Republicans are joining President Trump in baselessly questioning the outcome of the 2020 election, former President George W. Bush is extending his congratulations to the new administration. Bush said in a statement that he called both President-elect Joe Biden and his running mate Kamala Harris on Sunday. He described Biden as a good man who, quote, won his opportunity to lead and unify our country. Bush added that while Trump has the right to pursue legal challenges, Americans can have faith in the election process and its clear outcome. A Texas congressman expects the United States to rejoin a number of international agreements and bodies under the Biden-Harris administration. San Antonio Democrat Joaquin Castro is vice chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. He told NPR's Weekend Edition on Sunday one of the first steps Biden needs to take in office is reversing the Trump administration decision to leave the World Health Organization.
I think we should rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement, for example. I think we should also rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. So he's going to have to engage the United States in the world again, because our reputation, the perception of the United States around the world, has suffered during the Trump administration.
Biden says he plans to rejoin the WHO and the Paris Climate Accords as soon as he takes office. While exceptional to extreme drought conditions linger in far west Texas and the South Plains, Texas Public Radio's Brian Kirkpatrick reports rainfall totals elsewhere in the state are much more normal.
Victor Murphy of the southern headquarters of the National Weather Service in Fort Worth says the Midland-Odessa area has just recorded its driest 7 months ever. Only 1.6 inches of rain fell from early April to early November. He says it's partly bad luck and partly the La Nina weather pattern in the Pacific Ocean.
Whenever we see that pattern in effect, Texas has a very strong signal for seeing below normal rainfall or below normal precipitation during the winter and spring months.
Murphy says the South Plains are in drought conditions, too. He says 99% of the state, however, has received its normal rainfall amounts. Dallas is 8 inches above normal. I'm Brian Kirkpatrick in San Antonio.
More than 6,000 Texans are in the hospital due to coronavirus. The number of patients statewide has not been that high since August. According to data from the Department of State Health Services, Texas added over 5,400 new cases Sunday and 43 fatalities. That means at least 18,743 people have died from the virus here. The death toll in Texas is second only to that of New York. I'm Rachel Osier-Lindley for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Value Institute for Health and Care at UT Austin, offering executive education and a one-year online master's in healthcare transformation for working professionals across the health sector. More at utvalueinstitute.org.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Some of the preliminary data out after the election shows Latina voter turnout in key battleground states soaring. But who they voted for depends on the states they were in. Following this, for the 19th, the nonprofit, nonpartisan newsroom reporting on gender, politics, and policy, Chabeli Carazana. She reports on the economy for the 19th. Chabeli, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me again.
What preliminary data are you looking at here, and what does it say about Latino voters in particular this election cycle?
Yeah, so we were really keeping an eye on this going into the election because Latinx turnout was expected to be really, really high this year, as it has, you know, for other groups as well. But Latinas in particular, because with Latinas and Latinos, there is a very large gender gap in terms of who they support. And so what we're seeing in these early numbers is that Latinas actually tripled their turnout numbers for early votes cast on in this election. And like with anything when we're talking about, you know, this enormous voting block, it's very complex, it's very complicated. But overall, if we're doing broad strokes, Latinas tend to heavily support the Democratic candidate. And we're definitely seeing that for the most part throughout the country this year.
But I think that something that a lot of people have taken note of was a shift if you compare 2016 to 2020. How was that shift manifest?
Well, there's certainly a shift in terms of turnout, but there are also shifts in terms of who they're supporting. So everyone's been talking about Florida a lot because Florida went red this year by what in Florida is considered a blowout, three percentage points. And so in certain areas of Florida, the Cuban American population, for example, we saw definitely a break for Trump. But that doesn't tell the whole picture, right? So a lot of folks want to say, well, that's the Latino vote. It's the reason Florida went red, right? But there was a lot of white voters in Florida, for example, where Biden really underperformed in most counties in Florida with white voters. On the other end of that spectrum, Arizona is an area where Latinas really overperformed for the Democratic candidate. And what we're hearing from organizers on the ground is it's likely because Latinas delivered it for him.
Well, then it seems like a lot of this narrative, as I hear you talk, is in some ways influenced by our perspective or expectations. There are a lot of ideas behind presumptions about who would vote where and why, right?
There are a lot of presumptions, and it's, you know, going into this election, we were hearing a lot of questions as to whether the campaigns were really drilling in to what was really happening among different groups. You know, the Latinx vote is very affected by, you know, what country you came from, how long you've been in this country. Your gender obviously plays a role there. And so there was a lot of questions as to whether particularly the Democratic campaign was drilling into that enough in key battleground states, really reaching out to people from different backgrounds with different messaging that is culturally competent to those folks. And, you know, we were talking about Florida earlier. The answer in Florida is that that was probably not successful enough. And there are a lot of questions, you know, long term about how we look at this voter block and the sort of the nuances that play there in different areas of the country.
I've asked this question of several other experts, and I'm curious about how you would respond. Lena Hidalgo, who is the Harris County judge, was very open and public about inviting Joe Biden to come down and really push in Texas. The New York Times picked up on the fact that that just didn't happen. You know, Joe Biden didn't take advantage of that, and that there was a calculus made behind the scenes. It's ultimately not going to be worth it for me. Do you think that had that campaign made a focused push on South Texas, that the margins would have been tighter? In fact, we might have seen a different outcome?
I think it's very likely. I mean, if you're looking at some of the numbers coming out, particularly from the Valley, I mean, really startling losses there for the Democrats. Zapata County, I know we've been talking about that place in particular, but we've got, you know, Clinton carried that county with 30 points in 2016, and that county broke for Trump this year. And so there was certainly a lot of missed opportunity in that area. And, you know, part of that certainly is the Latinx vote, is Latinos and Latinas and where they went. But understanding what is happening there, certainly that was not happening with the campaigns. And so I think, yeah, I think ultimately on the ground efforts overall, not just in Texas, but overall, there needed to be more of that if the Democrats were going to narrow some of those margins in some of those areas. And because there wasn't, you know, we're seeing these huge blowouts in certain regions.
We've been talking with Chabeli Carrizana. She reports on The Economy for the 19th, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan newsroom reporting on gender, politics, and policy. Chabeli, great to have you back on the broadcast. Thanks again.
Thanks so much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, presenting the Intersect Ed podcast, where the stories of Texas public education policy and practice meet. Available at raiseyourhandtexas.org/podcast and most podcast platforms. Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com. Available in the dairy aisle.
Did you ever sit straight up in bed with something circling around your head and you swat at it as it whizzes by and it's just one pesky little fly? You shake your head and twitch your nose and settle down to sweet repose. And when you're just about to doze, fly trouble.
My name is Wizzy Brown and I'm with Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service and I work with insects.
Asian giant hornet, a.k.a. the murder hornet, but hopefully we are going to encourage people to use the proper name. That way we can have intelligent conversations. These are not currently found in Texas. They have been located in British Columbia and Canada, and they have been found in Washington State. But these are the world's largest hornet. They are about 1.5 to 2 inches in size. While they have been called the murder hornet, they are not murdering people. They actually will attack and destroy honeybee hives. So what they do is they go out, they decapitate the adult bees, and then the hornets will go in and take the larvae and the pupae out of the honeybee colony, and they take that back to their own nest so they can feed their developing reproductive. They can also attack other pollinators like bumblebees and things like that. So it's not just honeybees, but this is a concern for people who keep bees. So beekeepers that are in Texas, this is a concern for them if this insect were to be introduced into Texas. These Asian giant hornets are capable of stinging humans just like any other wasp or bee. They do have a stinger. The thing here is their stinger is longer because it's a larger wasp, and their venom does tend to be more potent than the regular wasps that we're used to. Some people can be allergic to the venom, and that could lead to anaphylaxis or death or something like that. So this is something that people do have to take care of if we were to get them. The good thing here is they are not in Texas currently. We do have a task force set up in Texas through Texas A&M University, and they are working on detecting Asian giant hornets when they move into Texas. So we are kind of putting the word out for people to report any possible sightings that they might see. The way that they would get transported into Texas most likely would be in cargo. So that is something that the task force is working with other governmental agencies so they can kind of monitor those areas where those wasps might actually move into Texas. Of course, they have people that are kind of serving as spotters, but they're also tagging the wasps with little micro transmitters so they can track where they fly and return to possible nesting sites. So then they can go and find if it's just a single wasp or if there are more wasps that they need to take care of.
I'm Wizzy Brown for the Texas Standard.
Wizzy Brown is a program specialist with Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service. Something bugging you? Ask us on social media or email texasstandard@kut.org and we'll put it to our insect expert. According to a national database titled Fatal Encounters, more than 2,000 people are projected to die this year during interactions with police officers. Some cities are implementing new policies requiring police departments to release body cam footage when an officer shoots a person or is accused of using excessive force. From KERA North Texas, Guns in America's Hadi Mawagdi has this report. And a quick warning, this story contains some audio some listeners may find disturbing.
The city of Dallas has one of the largest police departments in the country, and over the past several years, the city has spent millions on body-worn cameras. And the officers turn them on when they respond to incidents like this one from 2014.
Police.
A woman named Shirley Harrison had called 911 because her mentally ill son, Jason, was, quote, off the chain and incoherent. When Shirley answers the door, she explains her son's mental illness to the officers by saying he's, quote, bipolar schizo. Then Jason walks to the door holding a screwdriver.
Bipolar schizo.
What's going on?
You drop that for me. Drop that for me, guy.
Jay!
Drop it!
Jay!
Drop it!
Jay! Oh, you can't watch that!
Just 6 seconds after Jason appeared at the door, he's on the ground, dying. So with body cameras in Dallas capturing all sorts of interactions, deadly ones like this one, and routine ones too, it's worth asking, are cameras improving policing? Seth Stoughton says the results are mixed. The former police officer and investigator studies and writes about policing at the University of South Carolina, and he says there can definitely be benefits to cameras, but mileage may vary.
For example, Las Vegas showed a statistically significant decrease in use of force and a statistically significant decrease in civilian complaints, but Washington, D.C.'s Metropolitan Police Department did not.
Stoughton says factors like whether or not officers are required to record interactions and whether police supervisors review video and hold officers accountable play a big role in the success of police-worn body cams. The other factor is whether departments have consistent policies about releasing footage from body cameras and what they do to that footage before releasing it.
That protects the agency from accusations of unseemly delay, and it also lets the public know, look, good, bad, or indifferent, we will make sure that you get the video. If there's an issue, we will own it.
Dallas's Director of Community Police Oversight, Tanya McCleary, agrees with Stoughton. She helped craft a policy that requires DPD to release body cam footage within 72 hours of someone being hurt or dying during an interaction with officers.
I feel that a lot of things have been able to be brought to light because of the use of body-worn cameras and in-car cameras.
Still, she warns that we shouldn't put all of our eggs into the police body camera basket.
I was one of those people that when they said, we're going to start giving police departments cameras, that this was going to revolutionize, you know, police behavior. And I am really shocked about the number of times that it doesn't.
John Fullenweider isn't surprised.
The video doesn't prevent the shooting, but it does allow you a way to investigate the shooting.
properly. I mean, you really could say, no video, no justice.
Fullenweider co-founded the group Mothers Against Police Brutality. I spoke with him at a silent vigil in front of Dallas Police Headquarters, where moms sat in front of empty body bags wearing veils over their faces. And Fullenweider told me body cams and policies requiring police departments to release footage are worthwhile. But he's still skeptical.
Let's see what happens when there's a controversial shooting where the videotape makes the officer look bad. And then we'll see if they release it.
DPD's new camera policy aims to repair that sort of mistrust. But most experts say police-worn body cameras and the videos they provide are merely a tool. Real change comes from the top in the form of training and accountability. For Guns in America, I'm Hadi Mawagdi.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, recognizing cancer caregivers during National Caregiver Awareness Month. With over 200 locations, Texas Oncology and caregivers can be right here for their patients. More at texasoncology.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. One big winner from election night 2020 was called rather early on. Drugs. Voters in four more states approved recreational marijuana. In Oregon, a statewide proposition to decriminalize small amounts of drugs, including heroin, cocaine, and methamphetamine, also passed. Offenders will now be issued a ticket for possession of those harder drugs or have the option of receiving treatment funded by taxes from marijuana sales. But if Oregon is on the far left of the drug policy spectrum, Texas might be its ideological opposite. Bills to just reduce the penalties for pot possession have failed to gain traction in the Texas state legislature, much less full-blown legalization efforts. But could that change as drug rules continue to loosen up across the country? Joining us to talk about this issue, Catherine Neal Harris. She's a drug policy fellow at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy. Welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
So now that we've seen more of these drug-related measures pass in other states, where does Texas stand in terms of its policies when you compare it to where the country seems to be going as a whole?
I think that Texas is pretty far behind in terms of, you know, what it's doing to reform its drug laws, unfortunately. And I think that that's partly due to the fact that we don't have the ballot initiative process in the state. And so it's left up to the state legislature. And I think that's why you see Texas kind of falling behind other states in progress on this issue.
But I wonder, is there some value to being a latecomer in this regard? I mean, if I were an elected official in Texas, perhaps I might not think it was such a bad idea to watch Oregon take such a leap as it appears to have taken and see how it goes rather than be a trailblazer, at least on this matter.
I understand your point, and I think that there's certainly something to be said for an incremental approach. And I think that Texas itself could take that incremental approach right now. Right now, you know, possession of controlled substances like heroin and cocaine are considered a felony in this state. And so Texas could take an incremental approach and reduce the penalties for possession of those drugs without going towards full-blown decriminalization. And I think that that would be one way that the state could start to see some benefits without taking that larger leap.
What do we know about the economic and public health benefits of, let's focus on the legalization of recreational use of marijuana now that over a dozen states have done so? I think at one point there was the thought that California and Colorado might reap massive revenue increases, for example.
Yes, there has been a considerable amount of tax revenue that has been gained through legalization. And there's that cost as well as reduced cost of forcing marijuana prohibition against people. And so I think that there are certainly a lot of economic gains to be had from that. On the public health side of things, you know, I think that you do have to weigh the harms of prohibition against, you know, what might come from full-blown commercialization. And I think that there are ways to legalize that don't entail a full-blown commercial market that actually encourages heavier use. And I think that balancing those interests is where we can find a sweet spot policy. And hopefully that's the direction that we can see Texas move in.
Well, some cities in Texas have already moved somewhat in that direction, effectively decriminalizing possession of small amounts of marijuana. When do you expect the state as a whole to follow suit or even expand access for medical or recreational purposes for marijuana? Or do you think it ever will, given the political dynamics?
I think that it will eventually. I think, you know, I'm actually slightly optimistic for this session in terms of an expanded. Right now, there's a compassionate use act here in Texas that offers very limited access to a low THC form of cannabis. And I'm optimistic about the prospects this session for expansion of that bill to include more conditions and perhaps a higher cap on the amount of THC that's allowed. So I think we are moving in that direction. As far as decriminalization goes, the bill last session got further than it ever has before. And I think that we can continue to see support for that. We know that the majority of Texans do support decriminalization and medical access. And I think that going forward, we'll start to see more elected officials come around, especially because, you know, I think this past election has shown that, you know, even in very conservative states, for example, Mississippi, South Dakota, that went heavily for Trump, voters still supported legalization.
Catherine Neal Harris is a drug policy fellow at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy. Professor Neal Harris, thanks so much for joining us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar monitoring social media on this Monday. And what are Texans talking about, Wells?
Hi, David. Well, of course, since we last spoke, David, we have a new president-elect, Joe Biden. So we heard from plenty of folks over the weekend about that moment, where they were when they heard that the election had been called by the Associated Press and other news outlets in favor, definitively, of Joe Biden. Here's a sampling of what we heard via Twitter. David Polvado says he just came home from the grocery store and his neighbor ran out screaming that Biden just won Pennsylvania. Lisa Munoz Johnson, she says she was in a parking lot in Buda in central Texas leaving an estate sale, adding that she cried alone in her car. I like this tweet here from M. He says he was in bed hungover from a night of drinking, hoping it would get called the night before that previous night. Some question as to when that was going to occur, definitely. And I am Pat Grady. He says, I was walking in a neighborhood park and heard people cheering from their balconies with no words uttered. I knew exactly what they were cheering for. So definitely remarkable to see the sorts of spontaneous things that erupted in cities across Texas and across the nation when the news was announced on Saturday. So going to be fascinating to see not just what happens under a Biden administration, but what happens in the lead up to that time. Lots of questions remaining as to how the current administration will play things when it comes to a transition and other issues there, David.
I know that Joe Biden has said on day one of his administration he's going to start issuing a lot of executive orders, which will undo a lot of things that the Trump administration put into effect. So it will be interesting indeed to see what happens on January 20th, 21st of 2021.
And obviously, top of mind for the administration will be a coronavirus response. And it seems like a welcome bit of good news. We've been hearing here on this NPR station and other news outlets reporting that Pfizer apparently saying they have a vaccine that is shown, 90% effectiveness in clinical trials at this early stage, but still some a ray of sunshine, I guess you could say, should this preliminary data hold out and this vaccine be proven as effective as the drug company is touting. So lots of folks chiming in about this one as well. Jonna Blackley raising a little bit of concern. He says, I fear, though, there will be significant logistical problems. He notes that the vaccine needs to be stored at a very, very low temperature. How many facilities have the equipment to do that? Meanwhile, Leah Keese says it's good to hear that the work continues and that we're closer than ever to a vaccine. And Randall Monroe notes that I hope these numbers hold as this is early data from phase three trials. But as this article, as the information that we shared points out, it's definitely nice to hear some good news for a change on this front. So decidedly so. Let's hope that this news does hold out, David.
New York Times reporting that Pfizer plans to ask the Food and Drug Administration for emergency authorization of its two-dose vaccine later this month. We're out of time for the big broadcast. We'll be back here tomorrow. The news continues at texasstandard.org. We hope you'll join us there.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.